Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Kyle and Patrick's yet-to-be-named podcast. I'm Patrick McEwen, a.k.a. the Lacrosse Film Room Guy, here once again with my co-host, Inside Lacrosse Gear and Lifestyle Editor, Kyle Devitt.
What's up, guys? We're back. It's October.
And this week, we are joined by a special guest. Inside Lacrosse publisher Terry Foy is here to chat a little bit about fall ball, some industry news, or I guess to say the IL Industry Summit, and a little bit about Face Off Yearbook. So welcome to the podcast, Terry. Which is, I guess, kind of weird that you're thanking us for allowing you on the podcast of the enterprise that you run. So.
Well, I guess if you wanted to make it more existential, I'm thanking you for the, more than anything else, the passion and drive and ambition that you've brought to the podcast, because I have been a trumpeter of this platform along with a couple other folks inside Lacrosse for a really long time. And for a long while, it felt like a wolf, kind of crying in the distance. And the fact that others have picked up the mantle and run with it, and by others I'm referring most dramatically and specifically to you guys, is something I'm really enjoying. I enjoy listening to you. I would say each week, but I think we all know that you're not quite weekly at this point, or at this point in the year, it's hard to carry a weekly lacrosse podcast. But when it is time to pick up the microphone, I've enjoyed listening to you guys.
Well, thank you. I think the first topic that we're going to talk about, we're going to do some fall ball stuff. And I think the big fall ball game, certainly of this past weekend, but probably of the last couple weeks, was the Denver Canada scrimmage.
Yeah. Kyle, do you have any thoughts that you want to start with on that?
Yeah, I mean, it was really fun to watch Connor Carrizaro, possibly, the headliner for the Tewaraton this coming season, just dust people. I mean,
that wasn't just people he was dusting. A couple of cases, he was dusting the Hossacks.
Yeah, pros.
I mean, like, those aren't. Yeah, they're not just people. They're good enough defenders to get named.
It was pretty phenomenal. I mean, I think he made at least two people fall down just with a quick change of direction. Very, very awesome to see. I remember when I did the USA Way Ahead preview, I believe Bill Tierney said something to you, Terry, about me forgetting the best player in college lacrosse, and it was Connor Carrizaro.
I believe that's right.
So I guess we'll see how that turns out, but it looks like I was wrong on that based on that scrimmage footage. It was great to see. I think the U.S., when they scrimmage someone, gets so much pub and so much publicity, and deservedly so for being kind of, we're in the U.S. That's where most of the players come from. But seeing, the Canadians play against Denver and have that same kind of pride when they play that the Americans do was pretty awesome.
When you say same kind of pride, I feel like
it is the same pride because it's Canadians playing against Canadians.
Yeah, sure. I didn't mean that pejoratively. That's a positive. I'm being positive. MLL's over. I'm done being mean.
This is happy, Kyle.
Yeah, we're good.
Awesome.
We're talking gear. We're talking Canadians. Oh, I love Canadians.
I meant, though, I felt like especially the start to the scrimmage, we discussed beforehand, there were several Denver alumni who, based on the fact that they were returning back to their where they went to school, meeting up some of their college buddies, and the way they started playing the game, we can put together 2 + 2 and get 4 and realize that several of them may have been out a little bit too late the night before.
Yeah. Well, what I liked, they were celebrating the 2006 Denver team and their being the first team in program history to advance to the NCAA tournament. It's pretty remarkable how far that program came in 10 years to go from never having made it to the tournament to winning a national championship in 2015. But, one of the points that I came back to time and again as I was watching it was something that you hit on, Patrick, which is, who's Matt Brown going to coach? And it really underscored the connectivity between the Canadian national team and the Denver University men's lacrosse team, because there were so many Denver alums playing on that Canada team. I just thought it was really cool and really special, and definitely speaks to where the sources of success come from, not just with that national championship, but also with the 2014 gold medal that they won in Denver as well. I there were a couple other thoughts I want to, kind of quickly address. The first is, watching this, it makes it all the more kind of surprising that, this is a Denver team that lost its last two games of the season and got bounced out of the NCAA tournament in the first round. They were just so good last year. And you got to tip your cap once again to Towson for being able to pull off that effort. I think that one of the things I was interested in was where their defensive depth was going to – I'm sorry, their offensive depth was going to shake out with respect to the transfer of Brendan Bomberry. You know, I think you saw Austin French and Colton Jackson step up in a really meaningful way, so that's not a huge surprise. And then the last thing that came, you know, bounding out to me is just how many college players were on this Canada roster and how much talent there is spread across the young ranks of future Canadian national team members. I mean, you know, it was interesting to see guys like Zach Currier and Ian McKay and, you know, folks that Denver could theoretically be competing against in the spring playing, you know, coming out to campus and playing in this fall ball game.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought, I was thinking that sort of my two guys that I had an eye on most of all, given sort of the, for, given the stage was somewhat unusual for the two of them, was McKay, who at Vermont isn't playing, you know, a national championship caliber schedule, and Jason Weaver from Detroit, the goalie, who is at Detroit Mercy in the MAC, which is also, you know, they're not playing the national championship, you know, ACC type schedule that a lot of teams are. And so they're both guys who I think have been borderline All-Americans in the past. And the knock against them is just always that they're not playing the same competition everybody else was. And I thought Ian McKay had a pretty solid game. But I thought Weber and goal had a borderline outstanding game that I don't think there's any soft goals. He made a couple saves on the doorstep. And really every shot that he let in, I thought was inside of 12 yards in between the hashes. Was really not a save you expect your goalie to make every time.
And for the purposes of that conversation, it's pretty valuable for a guy like Bill Tierney to be on the opposite sideline when you're playing like that.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But I think, I think if you pay attention to the All-American discussions.
If you make a strong impression on a guy like him and he tells folks, hey, I really like this kid, you should keep an eye on him, it goes a long way. Meaning that like his opinion is one that people take seriously.
Yes.
Speaking of which, real quick about Detroit Mercy. Did you see that they changed their official school name back to Detroit Mercy after being only Detroit for a couple years?
I don't think that – my impression, I think that just was a branding decision. That
right.
I think they attempted to sort of in their athletics to just brand themselves as Detroit more so than Detroit Mercy. And I think they decided they weren't necessarily happy with the results of that and went back to calling themselves Detroit Mercy.
As long as they keep that sick logo, I mean, they can kind of
go Titans,
call themselves whatever they want. They have like some sort, they had a, so they're a warrior team and they had this amazing, like full half side of a helmet that was just like a Spartan like helmet with like swords and knives coming out of it. Looked great. Underrated things for that team.
It's a good segue into another fall ball game that I think we should talk about, even though none of us were there and, to my knowledge, saw any bits of it. Anybody have any other thoughts on Denver, Canada?
Just that offense is going to be tough to stop.
That is a solid summary statement.
And especially, it's also worth noting that Tyler Pace didn't play.
Yeah.
I want to say it's having played all those games to win the Minto Cup, that they would just see set out fall ball for rest purposes.
Yeah, I would assume that as well. I have one other thought. How about that one-handed fake pass that Dane Smith threw that you captured on?
Oh yeah, Twitter? that was something else. For those of you who haven't seen it, he was one-handed cradling with his right hand at the top of the stick and threw a pass fake like that.
It shouldn't work.
Got the Denver defender. It did, though. It got the Denver defender who was hedging and ready to slide. When he threw that pass fake, went back and looked to his guy. And he gave him the space needed to score.
I hate that move.
Did you guys see the Trey LeClair one-handed shot from the Carolina scrimmage the weekend prior that I posted?
I think so.
Okay, so it was similar in the sense that he was carrying right-handed against a defenseman who was on his left hip. And he was going to the middle of the field, but it was different in the sense that instead of faking a pass, he actually took a shot with only one hand on his stick, and it didn't go in. But he hit like the portion where the crossbar meets the post, and it ricocheted over the near sideline. It bounced all the way out over the near sideline that with such force that people like got out of the way on the Carolina bench. It was wild. So, you know, I don't think that anybody's unfamiliar with the idea that Canadians are one-handed, but when they are that effective and powerful with their one hand, and I'm using this in a humorous way because typically it means you have two hands on your stick, but you're only able to go one direction. No, this is when you legitimately only have one hand on your stick. They're still better than most of us are at lacrosse.
That's true. That also is a general sort of tangent off of that. It's interesting if you watch which hand Canadians use when they go with one hand on their stick, because there's more, I think for the most part they call them weak-handed lefties than you would think. That there's a lot of left Canadians who play lacrosse left-handed whose dominant hand is actually their right hand. And so then when they go one-handed, they'll almost always, they put it in their dominant hand, regardless of which hand they play lacrosse with. So just for example, like Jesse King will go one-handed right-handed. But a guy like Seth Oakes, who is a righty in lacrosse, will also go one-handed right-handed.
That's also
Jesse King's a lefty.
That's a big part of how they are taught lacrosse, how differently than the United States players are, where they learn it playing box. And not just by virtue of teams not, you know, the human population not being equal left-handed, right-handed, righties will be turned into lefties on a regular basis at the youth level. So kids learn how to play lacrosse left-handed that generally are not left-handed in real life or other purposes. So I think that's where you see a lot of that develop and where guys are kind of what you kind of refer to as converted lefties. Which is pretty interesting compared to how kind of, you know, we preach the, you know, Americans preach the play with both hands, play with both hands, play with both hands, when really, like, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to be dominant one hand regardless of how much you work on it.
Well, no, I mean, when the end of the day, the value proposition comes in that you have to be better as a left-handed player than someone else is as a left-handed player, regardless of whether or not you are predominantly left-handed. So if the combination of your athleticism and your ability to play lacrosse left-handed exceeds the other person that's competing for that spot, and you're bringing more value to your team than you would be if you were playing right-handed, then you're going to get the opportunity to get on the floor of the field. And what's crazy to me is that they don't then later on in life find themselves in rosters where they would be better suited to be right-handed and they have the ability to switch back. Or at least you don't see that happen very often. I find that fascinating. And the other thing that I find really fascinating is why this isn't a trend, the idea of teaching someone how to play lacrosse with his weak hand predominantly while he's young with American goaltenders. Because I think that there's such a track record of if you are a left-handed player as a goalie, you are more likely to yield greater success down the road. I remain so surprised that there aren't more kids who play goalie left-handed that are actually right-handed.
There are a couple of them, though. I know that Scott Rogers is that way.
Right, yeah. I'm not trying to argue that there are zero. I'm just trying to say that I'm surprised that there are more.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's one thing I've always thought developmentally, especially with the prevalence of people who advocate a more Canadian style to field lacrosse, of going more strong-handed. One of the reasons that can't work in some American places is if you have 90% right-handed kids, you can't run the same types of offenses and things that you run with your Canadian team and you have half lefties, half righties.
Yeah, the problem too is goalie-wise, like, the kid that's playing goalie probably doesn't want to play goalie most of the time in youth programs anyway. So, you're going to play goalie and also we're going to train your offhand. Like, you think that kid's not going home to his mom and being like, "Mom, they made me play goalie and made me play with my left hand. I don't think I like lacrosse."
But I just mean, though, in terms of American youth programs is – why not take more, do what Canadians do and take, if you're going to attempt to play that style, I think part of it is you have to try to make a 50-50 mix of lefties and righties. And I actually have done that. What you talk about converting, so I'm an anecdote, with a high school team I coached, we didn't have enough left-handed attackmen. So I picked two kids and I told them that they were now left-handed.
Well, the only place that can happen, you know, and have a lasting effect is at the youth level. Like, trying to convert people to play a different style in a different way after they have all their bad habits for playing their strong hand is really difficult.
It was 100% a great decision, because we didn't have enough lefties. Like, and I just told them that for the rest of the year, like, if you're messing, or anytime you don't have to use your stick right-handed, you're going to be a lefty, and don't be scared about being bad, because we're going to play a left-handed attackman on the field. So you're going to play just as much or more as you would. You free them from feeling like they're trying to fail by using their left hand. And it worked out. It was great for the team's success, because they improved significantly as lefties, because they were the designated lefties more than we would have if I didn't designate who our left-handed attackman was going to be. Because the year before we didn't have that, and we had a struggle of not having enough lefties, and we were better because of it.
Well, and the other thing, Kyle, I disagree with your thought that once a player's bad habits are ingrained, trying to apply something completely new would be counterproductive. It's really counterintuitive to me. If you have bad habits, then the only way to erase those bad habits is by starting at square one. And that's essentially by converting to be a lefty.
It's really hard at a certain level to do that, and almost not worth your time, depending on how much time you have to spend doing that versus doing the rest of the stuff you're already trying to do. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying there's no value in it. I'm just saying if you're going to do it, you're going to have to do it the younger the better.
Like, right, obviously the younger the better, but I'm talking about, though, taking a kid who was grew up playing, learning to be a two-handed attackman, but a dominant righty two-handed attackman, and basically telling them to practice as a dominant lefty two-handed attackman.
Yeah.
Speaking of not worth your time, do you mind if I transition to the comment that I was going to make a couple minutes ago?
Yes, I thought we were going to talk about UNC and Ohio State.
No, we were going to talk about Cleveland State, because the segue, which was perfectly set up, was oversized graphics on Warrior helmets. And that's exactly what the Cleveland State Vikings have. And they played another team for the first time in program history, albeit in a game that did not count, on Sunday. And according to Ohio Boys Lex, who was on scene, John Smallman for Inside Lacrosse, the Knights emerged as, I believe it was 17-8 victors over Cleveland State. In a game that seemed like, just by reading the score updates, it was competitive early. He mentioned a few guys who impressed, and it started at the defensive end with Zach Whitenack, who was the first commit in program history, which I think is a good sign when the first player that you get to commit to your program ends up being good. Maybe your best player in your opening scrimmage. And then talked about a few other guys. Bobby Kidd is a freshman defenseman from Port Moody. Zach Wendell was a midfielder from Faith Lutheran in Las Vegas. And then a pair of East Coast attackmen, Jake Lewis from Casanova in New York and Stephen Massey from Easton in Pennsylvania, all impressed. And then lastly, Danny Tesler, a faceoff guy at Allatoona, Georgia. So it sounds like the pieces are in place for Dylan Sheridan. And I think that, whether it's somebody with a Ohio perspective like myself and Patrick, or a general fan of Division I lacrosse and the growth of the sport in general, like Kyle, you can take a lot of heart in the fact that the newest Division I men's program for the 2017 season sounds like it's going to be, pretty good heading into the year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest for a first year program, even you're just trying to be competitive and not, get run off the field.
Exactly. Pretty good, I'm referring to in the spectrum of first year programs, which, obviously have their own standard for success.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad as an Ohioan, definitely glad to see a second program. And especially one that has, they have a big advantage in terms of recruiting, being a state school and having a pretty affordable in-state tuition. That for a lot of kids, I think they're set up for success, and that Ohio State really is recruiting kind of with the top 20 programs, and there's sort of a ton there's enough kids playing in Ohio that are the state is producing kind of that next tier of talent, and it gives them a place to go in state with affordable tuition.
Not to mention the fact that they're riding this wave of success in Cleveland sports, coming off of LeBron James leading. Hell, there we go. That was the reaction that I was waiting for.
I tried to hold it in, man. I couldn't. I tried. I can't do it.
You're one of those, like, you know, 13 parades in the last 11 years or whatever it is.
Yeah, except I remember being a kid and we still were terrible at everything. And that's
so you can you can understand exactly why Cleveland fans would be excited about it.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I can. That was a great commercial for Cleveland State, guys. It was a great job. I want to go there now. Although, speaking of Cleveland, since we're segueing in a professional manner, I got to see one of Cleveland's or Ohio's finest in Joe Williams of Throne Lacrosse did the first annual, at least to my knowledge, live stream of just like on a Saturday, set up his webcam, did a live stream of him stringing ahead, of him fielding questions from people that use his product. It's really one of the first times I've seen a brand of any level in lacrosse directly kind of interact like that with people. And just watching it, I mean, it was 3 hours long plus. I can't say I watched all 3 hours, but I watched at least two. And the things that I kind of picked up from it is the ease with which he, as the ambassador for his brand, interacted with all the different, you know, a lot of lacrosse is selling to kids, right? So his interaction with them was actually really, you know, fairly mature considering his audience. And his audience was, I mean, aside from a few people saying some not great things in the chat comments, like very, very in sync with kind of the attitude of his brand and of lacrosse. And it was really fascinating to watch. I mean, he live strung a stick. He unboxed Mavericks' new Max gloves. Kind of talked about those for a bit. They have a established relationship with Maverick and Cascade, Throne do. And, you know, kind of at the end of it, he released 25 more pieces of his limited edition cure, breast cancer cure mesh, which I thought was cool. Like, just kind of using that avenue as an unveiling. I know that as far as that goes, East Coast Dyes is going to do a similar thing when they release their new products, which I think everyone knows is ahead, but I don't want to like spoil that for them. And that's going to happen next, this coming week. And it's, you know, just seeing Throne kind of not beat them to the punch, but like kind of have that interaction with the community was so interesting from a perspective of like marketing and branding and lacrosse. And seeing that you can really reach out and connect with the audience through something like YouTube, Periscope, this podcast. I mean, I don't know if you guys have noticed, other podcasts have kind of popped up in the last couple months in addition to ours. And it's really interesting to see these different perspectives and profiles of lacrosse, like luminaries out there, like in the ether, in the space.
Well, I think there's no question that it's not limited to lacrosse. I mean, it's a trend across media and it's a trend across marketing that level of connectivity with your audience is paramount in terms of success. And if you can attain that, you know, I think that when it's, you know, the term that people use is social influencer. And I think that a lot of times that's a catch-all for something that's a lot more difficult to explain. But I think what people try to mean when they say it is that whoever this person's intended audience is just likes to watch them on YouTube or likes to hear what they have to say. And I think that there's no question that that's, you know, it's exactly what you try to do when you create content. I will say that it's a huge cultural shift because, you know, when you date yourself back to the mid to late 90s, when there were, you know, there was a limit on the number of places that you could go for media content, whether or not you liked the person providing it to you was a lot less important because you didn't have any control over whether or not they were going to continue to provide it to you. You were looking for that outlet simply for lack of alternatives, and that doesn't exist anymore. And I think that the savviest of brands, you know, and I think you got to give a lot of credit to the different types of lacrosse, you know, what you would in some word describe as startup or small 5 years ago, you know, they understood that in a way that a lot of the established brands didn't. And so they have now all the vested equity of having done that for a really long time. And it's why, Joe and the folks at ECD and others are able to take advantage of it now. And when they do bring themselves to a live presence like that, get a good reaction.
Yeah, I think if you talk to someone in like 2001 and told them that Gate was going to be gone, but they would be replaced by seven different companies, you know, smaller companies that make up the space that's been vacated by, at that time, what was kind of a major brand in terms of sponsorship and presence in the lacrosse market, I think people would tell you you're crazy. I mean, even though we're kind of built on, you know, as a lacrosse publication and media and a content creators that we are, we're still built on the future of what lacrosse is going to be. And I think that seeing these guys who have already realized that and have taken that kind of step to connect with a brand, use their brand to connect to that kind of, not vacancy, but opening in the industry is fascinating and awesome.
I disagree. I disagree that there's a kind of one for one type of trade. I think that the category of lacrosse manufacturing that was more than any other way born out of the manufacturing and selling of different types of conditioned mesh was a market that didn't previously exist. I don't think that they popped up as the result of anybody else.
But that's not why they exist now. They exist now to...
Yes,
to
it is.
Well, they're not growing into
I don't
that.
Think it's
that
their largest...
Saturated.
I don't.
Saturated. There's no...
I know, and that. I don't think their mesh sales are their largest asset. I think that their marketing platform is. And I think that they all, you know, collectively are realizing that the best way to utilize that is to parlay it into other types of product sales. But I once again dispute the notion that it's the result of an individual brand.
No, it's not. I mean,
leaving the market and all of their share opening up.
I mean, the share is relative to the value of the more people playing it as well. I mean, there's more people playing lacrosse than there were in 2001. And thus there's more need. But it's also, I mean, yeah, you probably don't want to say this, but I'm going to say this. It's also due to the decline of the major manufacturers' influence on the marketplace due to their sales.
Well, I mean, no, that's another place that I would dispute the general point. I would say that that is true insofar as a lot of major brands didn't identify how big the vertical of string supplies was going to become.
Yes, yeah, I'm with Terry on this, and I also think. I think you made a good point that in a lot of cases, their biggest asset is sort of their branding and their marketing and the communication channels. Because I actually thought when Adidas came back into the market that potentially they would have been wise to look into acquiring one of those companies to sort of be the launch to serve as sort of the spokesperson for the launch of the Adidas gear.
Yeah,
well, particularly given the fact that the world has seen a transition in terms of who spokespeople are. Like, for example, I think that it's tremendously telling that Adidas's most lucrative sponsorships have to do with Kanye West and not with athletes.
Right.
And that's a substantial shift from the world that we lived in 15 and 20 years ago.
Right, but experts are not putting that up to that. Experts are putting that up to the casual increase in athleisure, not to the influencers. Like, if you read, like, Matt Powell, who's a leading...
I'm not industry. Saying it's a one-to-one comparison.
Well, that's kind of what I was trying not to say that came out wrong. But, I mean, as someone that I did buy for a store, I did run a lacrosse store, the volume is down in terms of what you spend with the majors versus what you spend with kind of these mid-major and minor, lower companies that weren't around 10 years ago. Like, the spend per... kind of, and online has actually affected this a lot too. So that, I think that's kind of where the real shift is where, you know, you're having...
I don't think it's a function of the spend being down. I think it's a function of the rate of growth being slower for larger established brands than it is for smaller brands and less established brands.
Because there's more brands.
Exactly.
Right, kind of also, point, you also have to consider, though, like, that Under Armour and now Adidas and Nike... are all you think of them as big brands, but really in the lacrosse world, they're relatively new. They're sort of quasi startup. They're almost big corporate startups in the lacrosse world that have entered the marketplace that weren't there 10 years ago.
Right.
Kyle, you transitioned us away from actual lacrosse on field stuff way too fast.
Well, that's what I do. I create tangents and destroy things.
We were going to talk about a lot of other stuff. I wanted to talk about Matt Kinnear was out in Minnesota at the National Sports Center in Blaine, Minnesota, to watch Marquette take on Fairfield. And I was really excited to see how this matchup played out for two reasons. The first is Marquette was an incredibly good senior-laden team last year. I think that there's a very unique one-time opportunity to, quote-unquote, strike while the iron is hot when you have a group of seniors as a startup program who have been on campus for 4 or 5 seasons and they are leaving campus. And I think that was the situation that Marquette and High Point were faced with last year. High Point to that point had already actually taken advantage of it, having made it to the NCAA tournament the year prior. And that was essentially that secret sauce that put the Golden Eagles over the top. And I was curious to see, how are they going to bounce back? They graduated so much talent. As you see, several of those guys move on to success in Major League Lacrosse. And on the other end of the spectrum, given the way that their season ended in the CAA championship against Towson, I thought Fairfield was one of the most underrated squads last year for how close they were to the NCAA tournament and how few people realized that or knew about it. And I thought that it went hand in hand with Colin Burke being only behind Pat Spencer in terms of impact freshman in 2016. And so I was very curious to see how that shook out, right? Like, was it going to look like those two trends were going to continue, that being the upward trend for Fairfield and the kind of reset button trend for Marquette? And based on following Matt Kinnear on Twitter, it kind of has. He made it clear that Colin Burke was the best player on the field, and I think that Marquette is going to have to look to some places and guys that haven't been on the field very much over the course of the last couple seasons to find their stability as they transition into year 5 of the program.
I think those were very good thoughts, and I agree generally with everything you had to say. I also think in the case of Marquette, one sort of indicator that replacing some of those guys they lost is going to be difficult is sort of the pro success that Liam Burns, BJ Grill, and Jacob Richards have had.
Yep.
That I think anybody who had any doubts about BJ Grill's ability to be a big time defender despite his small stature were answered with the Outlaws Championship. That he won. He was on the field playing for the MLL champions. And it's hard to knock his college success after seeing that. Liam Burns made an impact for Florida, and Jacob Richards got an invite to the US the US men's team inter-squad scrimmage a couple of weeks ago.
I would build on that point by making a similar argument about Brown. Yes. I don't think that there was a, kind of lack of everybody knew Brown was good. So, and there wasn't that much doubt as to how good they were, but their players, so many of their graduated seniors made such an impact in Major League Lacrosse that it was clear that they really are good. It was a reaffirmation, so to speak. And so I think that the point is be a little bit more cautious when you project how good Brown is going to be heading into 2017.
No, I still think they're going to be great. Come on.
Do you actually think that?
Yes, I do. Okay. I don't think they're going to be as good, but they're still going to be great. I would put their performance last year as stellar and out of this world, like one of the best in
program history.
Program history. But I don't think they're going to necessarily achieve that this year. But I think it's in play. I don't think it's like out of the stadium. I think you're still in play there.
Yeah, I think last year Brown was a national title contender. And I think this year you look at more Brown as an Ivy League title contender.
Yeah, I think Brown is clearly the second best team in the Ivy League behind Yale, but they are probably closer to Penn, who I think is going to be the third best team, than they will be to Yale.
I think that's fair.
I mean,
the X factor, though, is Dylan Malloy. We talked about Connor Candazzaro maybe being the best player in the country. I think the player who should give us hesitation about that is Dylan Malloy, and I think having an offensive and having an attackman who can go and who is not afraid and is capable of dodging against the other team's best defender and scoring is the single biggest weapon you can have in lacrosse, and they have that.
Yes, they do, and he's coming off of a Jones fracture, which isn't a thing that puts a season in doubt the subsequent year. he's very fortunate in the sense that he's not going to be tempted to push it to come back quickly the way that you see happen so frequently with that injury. And I will say that, you know, as it relates to the reason I'm bullish on Brown, despite how many players they graduated, I mean, just listen to these names. These are guys that are gone. Balistri, Blinn, Tills, Caputo, Graham, Gural.
I mean, it's the starting five.
Jack Kelly.
The starting five on offense, aside of Dylan Malloy, plus the two sort of specialists, the faceoff guy and the goalie.
Yeah, so they have a good spine because they have a good ex-attackman. I think Carson Song, you know, he was a, you know, when you look at his numbers, he was a 16-point. Yeah, he showed him flashes. He was a 60-point guy, but he was weighted towards assists, which I think is always valuable because it implies a playmaking ability that supersedes an ability to score goals. That being said, when you take on a bigger role, you need to be able to score in order to draw slides. But, you know, so from that to the long stick midi to the defenseman that brings the ball off the field a lot. And I do think that they're going to have a good goalie regardless of who ends up winning the job. First of all, because Brown always does.
Yeah.
And second of all, because coming out of the fall, that was certainly pointed to as being an asset. But I do think that winning faceoffs is going to be extremely influential to their ability to play that style. One guy that also graduated that people might forget about because he only put up two goals was John Jazzo Scaparata, who definitely brought a toughness to them defensively. So my point, I think Brown is a borderline top 10 team. I think they're going to be incredibly fun to watch, as you would expect. I think that it was a good year for a coaching change because there's a... I don't know. I feel like complacency is definitely something you have to battle when you come off of a season like they did last year. And I think that having to prove yourself to a new coach is really valuable. But I also think that, yeah, there's going to be a stiff challenge toward replacing all those guys that we just listed.
Coaching-wise, there's no better transition to make, though, right?
From Lars to Daly?
Yeah.
No doubt. No, I mean, the programs are so familiar or... being at one will feel like having been at the other. You know, and I think that there's an element to that that is like kind of related to the Malloy family. You know, Dylan's brother played at Tufts. He considered going there before deciding to go to Brown. Like, there's a lot of logic between how all that interconnectivity works.
I think you're spot on with Song, by the way, too. I think his greatest asset is dodging off the catch, which he didn't get a lot of... He didn't get a lot of burn doing that last year, but watching him how they kind of used him as like the third guy in case Malloy wasn't getting off or teams were shutting off Blinn or Balistri. He was really good on the wing, right on that hinge area by GLE, kind of setting up his guy and taking them upfield and making something happen with his feet and his hands. And, you know, he's not a natural goal scorer, but I think he's a natural playmaker. And that's definitely something that adds another dimension to Brown that I think people are going to underestimate, hopefully. Not hopefully, but probably will underestimate. I think he's gonna put up big points. I really do.
I think speaking of that ability to create from like down low GLE, I think one of the – you think of Dylan Malloy as this bull-dodging sort of inside role guy, and I think one of the things people don't think about as much with him but is a true an asset of the game is the two-man game. And he kind of lost his primary partner of that with Bailey Tills being gone. But I think that that's going to allow him to help other guys get going with him setting picks back there and teams being afraid to switch their best long pull off of
him. Well, I'm excited to watch Brown not initiate with Caputo 50 times and watch him dodge into black holes. So that's going to be fun. Whoever else they put in there dodging from the top is going to be good to watch.
Which of those two guys do you think is more likely to be successful at the MLL level, Caputo or Tills?
Tills.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because of his like athletic profile or because of his style of play?
Style of play. I think Caputo's too, his foot speed isn't high enough and he dodges with his head down. And if you do that in the MLL, you're going to get lit no matter how big you are. Like someone's going to come after you. And I think you saw, I mean, he played for Charlotte a couple, I think two games.
It says four according to your favorite website.
Yeah, well, we know that's not always accurate. So I don't know. I mean, I think, especially with Charlotte making that trade, that's going to be a tough roster for him to crack anything more than the second midfield line. But with Tills, it's funny, like Tills didn't play in every game either, but what he did give the Outlaws was a extra guy to catch and go to the cage. And that's what the Outlaws used the whole time. Is they ran, one of the secrets to their success was running fresh legs at people. And Tills is always fresh, especially if he's, even if he's running out of the box, going down low, doing a spot replacement for a guy. He did really well, and he had one of the best goals of the season, going kind of over his head and scoring on a run from X on his offhand with a no look.
I just think Tills, he's so versatile. He can come out of the box. He can play attack. He can play behind. He can invert as a midfielder. He can dodge he can dodge downhill from up top. And I think his assets as a player, it's more, I think his stick, he has an MLL level stick and MLL level sort of IQ. And I think Caputo relied more on his physical assets being bigger and faster than people. And in the MLL, I don't think he's bigger and faster than people. And it's going to be a tougher adjustment for him.
I mean, not to keep going on the Brown train or whatever, but, you know, Jack Kelly is going to be very tough to replace. I mean, we saw how good he is. You know, he went to the pro level and basically dominated. He should have won goalie of the year. Like, no shots at Galloway. I know he's mad that I already said something about it, but, like, he transformed an entire team with his play. I mean, how many times do you have 20 saves in a game? 4, 5, 6 out of, like, 9 games that he played? That's an amazing MLL campaign, and he was really underrated in that Brown system, taking a ton of shots and getting the ball over the top of the offense that was riding and just starting breaks by himself. So I think as long as Brown has somebody that can outlet, not even stop the same amount of shots, can outlet like Kelly did, they're going to be in a better spot. So hopefully whoever they have coming in as the backup last year or a new goalie perhaps can do that as well as Kelly did.
Speaking of John Galloway, though, one program I think that has gotten a lot of attention recently that hasn't not or far more attention recently than they have historically is John Galloway's new team, Jacksonville. And I was curious, Terry, if you had any thoughts about them now that we've kind of seen some now they've kind of been through fall ball with Galloway and Powell down there.
I think it's going to be a multi-year project.
Yes. Okay. That's, I mean, Kyle and I have briefly mentioned this as well. And that's why I think having watched, I didn't watch a ton of Jacksonville last year, but watching them a couple times, it's going to be a multi-year project to get talent.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because I don't like the term dead cat bounce, for a lot of reasons. You know, on the one hand, it's really, really morbid. But on the other hand, I think that it gets taken for granted a lot. The idea that just a new voice will yield positive results undersells how valuable the quality of the voice is. And if you have a good new voice, then the degree to which you can produce and be better than you were is much higher than if you have a relatively not so good new voice. And I think that, you know, certainly there's very little doubt in anybody's minds as to how good of players John Galloway and Casey Powell were. That being said, John Galloway is a head coach for the first time in his career, and Casey Powell is a college lacrosse coach for, as far as I'm aware, the first time in his career. So, you know, I think that there's a learning curve there, right? So, like, there's no question that, you know, Jacksonville is going to benefit from the increased profile of having those two guys involved. But I do think that that's a little bit of a longer-term play. You know, you have to give guys who are uncommitted or an opportunity to decommit and come to your program first and foremost. And then secondly, I also think that they themselves need to learn a little bit about what they want their style to be like as they fill those new roles. You know, I think that there's often not enough, and it's the reason for this is because it's hard to analyze, but a lot of times not enough analysis is paid to the difference in the quality of performances among coaches. I think coaches can get better and coaches can get worse, and sometimes it is difficult to know when that's happening. But I think that for new coaches, it's easy to assume that they will get better and potentially get better pretty quickly because the learning curve tends to be pretty steep. But I think that as far as on-field results and records, I wouldn't expect a significant jump out of the Dolphins this year because, you know, they lost their two highest producing players from last season. And I think that, you know, is a stiff challenge to overcome. But at the same time, you know, there were some other things that were going on with the program that, you know, weren't positive headlines, and hopefully they can avoid those. And I think that you've already seen some excitement coming out of the guys who have committed to play for that team. I just don't expect to see double digit wins in 2017.
in terms of fall ball stuff, anything else? Any other games anybody wanted to discuss, Kyle?
Not necessarily games, but the second piece in my D2 life series is up. Franklin Pierce. I know I got a lot of flack for describing the fog, but let me tell you, I went light on that description because that fog was like mystical. And it's funny, that campus. I used to work there. I was a coach there in 2000, assistant coach 2005, and it is very much the same place, but also the program is so different and for the better. Just watching, kind of. Guys get up. I went to a 6 a.m. practice, and seeing guys go to a 6 a.m. practice, you don't generally see that level of enthusiasm that I saw. So I think it bodes well for them. They had a very down year last year as opposed to the year before, where they broke the record for wins in a season by the team and went to the NE10 playoffs. Played LeMoyne. I think people are underestimating the NE10. I think it might be the best conference in lacrosse in terms of top-to-bottom talent and competitiveness. And I'm really enjoying doing this series. I got St. A's coming up next, also a place that I coached in 2006, the year after I coached at Pierce. So, it's great to kind of have the macro view of a lot of D1 stuff, but, I really do enjoy doing micro stuff and seeing these other programs that maybe people have never even heard of before and giving them kind of a spotlight that they definitely deserve.
Are you a believer in 6 a.m. practices? Do you think it's the right way to lead your program?
I think, for the most part, it's something you have to do more than something you want to do. And I don't think that it's a tone setter, no, if that's what you're asking.
Why do you you have to do it because that's when you have field availability, particularly in the non-spring?
Yes. That has been my experience at everywhere that I've coached, is that's the only slot that's open.
Well, a lot of coaches do it by choice because they think it keeps their players out of trouble because you can't go out the night before. If that is it, from that frame of mind, what's your opinion?
It also keeps your players angry at you if you're into that.
Right.
So I think doing one or two a week, I think doing all five at 6 a.m. it's like, that's suicide.
It's just very difficult to get enthusiasm consistently, right?
Right. It's difficult to do anything at 6 a.m. with any sort of athletic regularity unless you've been doing it for a long time.
Right.
That's kind of the thing you build up in your kids. And do you play games at 6 a.m.? No. So it's good for conditioning, I think. That's my kind of view on it. I think it's a great time to do a lot of conditioning. But, if we're talking about higher level programs, they don't worry about that. That's not their time. That's their practice time.
Right.
So they use it for other purposes. But yeah, I mean, I remember my first 6 a.m. practice ever that I played in was in high school. And I played a bunch of sports in high school, but I never practiced at 6 a.m. until I played lacrosse. And it was like being a zombie the rest of the day. And I was like, how do people do this? Like every day, this is crazy.
Right.
But being a coach, it's different. And it does have different applications, I think. But I don't think that it's bad or good. It just depends on what works for your team and what is available to your team that does a lot more of the dictating than the timing of it. Patrick, what do you think?
I think if you are expecting, I think you can't do them all. Or you're wasting, it's sort of in a sense a waste of a practice because that you're not going to get the peak performance out of your players, making them get up at 6 a.m. to go practice. But I do think potentially the Friday morning 6 a.m. practice to keep kids from going out on Thursday night is a potentially an effective tool. Just be glad that it's 6 a.m. Back in my marching band days, once had a 4:45 a.m. practice.
Oh my goodness.
I got out of bed to go to practice right as my roommate was getting home.
I was going to say, that's one of those you just go straight through. You don't even bother going to sleep.
Oh, no, you have to, though, because it's morning of game day.
Oh, right. Okay, that makes sense. So you're pot committed until...
Yeah, like till like 3 or 4 or 5 in the afternoon.
Right.
So you got to sleep. You got to sleep.
I tell you what, you haven't lived until you pull the kid out of bed to get him to go to practice. It is dorm. That is an exciting experience as a coach. I enjoyed it. And it happened to Pierce a lot more at Pierce than anywhere else that I coached at. But that is definitely not the case with that program at this point. I don't know if I said this in the piece, but there was well over 40 players on the field on time for 6 a.m., which you know, that's an ordeal. It's an ordeal. But that's an interesting question. I think, you know, it has a lot of different applications, for sure, this exciting practice.
Okay, transitioning then a little bit out of fall ball and a little bit head towards 2017 previews. One of the things that we wanted to talk about while we had Terry on, since he kind of spearheads a lot of this, is giving you guys a look into what the behind the scenes of compiling the much anticipated face-off yearbook preview and preseason ratings.
Yeah.
Rankings.
So it's been a process that's developed year over year over the last 8 or so that I've been involved. And I would say it's interesting. I mean, it, you know, now has become something that's going to sound much more rudimentary than I think it actually is. But essentially the way it starts is by creating a spreadsheet of all 71 Division I men's teams. And, you know, in one cell having their record, in another cell having their RPI finish, in another cell having all the players that they graduated, another cell having all their seniors, having their returning contributors, and having their, you know, new arrivals that are expected to make an impact. And it ends up becoming a very visual exercise. It starts by utilizing last year's finishing place and then essentially shell gaming teams up and down on the basis of how significant their losses are and how significant their returning players are. And, you know, I essentially take an initial stab at it because I can't help myself when I'm actually filling out the spreadsheet. And then I share it with all the folks that contribute inside the cross consistently throughout the year. So that includes our full-time staff. But then, you know, also guys like Quinn Kasnick and Mark Dixon and Christian Sweezy, you know, who routinely contribute and watch a lot of lacrosse. You know, some folks share it beyond that to get thoughts. And then it becomes a sounding board exercise as we, receive all the feedback and try to implement it in a way that builds a representative consensus. But I think one of the things that is fun about the exercise but also problematic is that the Face-Off Yearbook rankings are essentially an organizational tool whereby we can assign the previews. I don't think that we do them in a way that we expect them to be considered gospel, because there's so much that changes between when the rankings are assigned and, you know, when teams finally hit the field in the spring, that if we had an opportunity to change things, like just as an example, last year, and this is not an exaggeration, we transmitted the Face-Off Yearbook to the printer. We still had at that point about 24 hours to make changes. Got the news that Joel Tinney was going to be suspended and miss the 2016 season, and went to work to change every single mention of Joel Tinney in the yearbook. But at that point, we can't change Johns Hopkins' ranking when, justifiably, his absence changes where they would have fallen in the national picture. You know, and I think that to a degree, that's representative across the board. Not only do things change, but also, you know, there are different things that are difficult to put a value on unless you're inside the program all the time. So, you know, again, for us, it's exciting. It's one of the few times that I think teams are subjectively ranked from top to bottom over the course of the season, you know, outside of the top 20 in particular. But that's essentially the process. It can definitely be better, but to this point, it's served us pretty well.
Do we want to, I guess, is there any sneak preview? Who's in the top consideration?
Yeah.
Consideration for number one?
More than even a consideration, I'll just say that this is probably the most difficult number one. And it's not just number one, because sometimes it's difficult to pick one between two teams, for example. It's like, number one's going to be one of these two teams, and it's really easy from there.
Like, last year it was Denver Notre Dame.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's been, you know, I remember in 2010, Duke and Syracuse were a really hot debate as to who was going to be number one heading into the season. You know, this year, as you look at it, I could imagine four teams, Denver, Notre Dame, Carolina, and Maryland, all having a legitimate claim to be preseason number one, and then all having a really substantial argument against it. So, I mean, for example, throw out a team and I'll tell you why they shouldn't be number one.
Notre Dame.
Because their most important late game player graduated after being one of the leading scorers in program history.
But they have Sergio Perkovic.
Patrick, can you explain why having Sergio Perkovic is not a claim for being number one?
I ended up writing like 500 words about this very thing, but I think he's the best shooter, but he's not Miles Jones. and he's not going to be Miles Jones in terms of like that, the midfielder who you can run the entire offense through and have the ball in his stick all the time.
I agree. And I think that when you look at Notre Dame's strengths in comparison to their weaknesses, you know, they're going to have one of the deepest stables of defense, short stick D middies that any of us will have ever seen. I'm not exaggerating when I say they have like seven guys that,
and not to mention any team would want. Not to mention John Sexton. I think you say just their defensive midfield would have to be, maybe potentially could end up in the conversation for the best ever.
Right. And so, you know, in order for them to reach their potential and be as good as you would want them to be, a couple of those guys are probably going to have to contribute offensively. That doesn't seem like, you know, a super great bet based on kind of the skill set there. So, you know, and it doesn't just end with Kavanaugh in terms of the guys that they lost. I mean, obviously Landis was the two-time Schmeisser Award winner. In that way, it feels a little bit like, probably even more so, you know, I made that comment earlier about I don't lack for confidence about Brown's goaltending because Brown always seems to have good goalies. You're not going to lack for confidence about Notre Dame's top end defensive player because they're always going to have a guy that's going to compete for a first team All-American nod. But it's also Eddie Glazner, you know, who was kind of their communication guy. So they graduate their top two close defensemen.
Glazner was the third, drew the third assignment. Apple was the number two cover guy.
Okay, so...
And I think, I would also say, having observed them at practice, that I think I don't have any concerns about their defensive leadership. I think Eppel and Nick Kishansky...
Uh-huh.
The defense is never the concern with
Shane
Notre Dame.
They're going to be fine defensively in terms of leadership.
Yeah.
It's never the concern, though.
I think if you want to have a question about their leadership, it's definitely on the offensive end, because last year, I think... I would say to a lot of people, it was sort of a two-star situation with Kavanaugh and Perkovic, but it was Kavanaugh's team. And now he's gone. And Perkovic, I will say, in all the time that I've spent watching on the sidelines of Notre Dame games or Notre Dame practices, I don't think I've ever heard him say more than two words.
Right.
I would love to see a Notre Dame offense that didn't look like a math equation every time I watched it. That's what I would love to see. I've never seen it.
What do you mean by that?
I would love to see it.
What do you mean by that?
It's a paint-by-numbers offense. I mean, Kavanaugh was one of the only guys in, like, the history of Notre Dame for, like, the last 8 years to, like, have freelance ability and have, like, kind of the confidence to go off book. I think not that it's easy to defend because their talent is high. I think just watching it, there isn't a lot of improvisation. It's like watching a play.
I think it's potentially fair, but, I mean, Ryder Garnsey it's so weird watching them because he's number 50 now.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a lot of translatable skill there.
You just have this instinct of like, did Matt Kavanaugh grow 4 inches? It's about as much of a drop-in replacement as any team has ever had.
But he's going to have a much shorter leash, as evidenced by last year, than Kavanaugh had.
You're saying that just because he's younger?
Yes.
I think that's probably a good thing.
That's fair.
And not only that, so, you know, it's hard to project freshmen, but I do think that Brian Willis is one of the safest bets among the entire freshman class to be a substantial contributor. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I mean, watching, I actually, when I first went and watched them at practice, they hadn't updated the roster on their website yet, so I didn't have a roster, and I actually didn't really know who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like one. He was the one player that caught my eye that I went to ask somebody, who is that?
Yeah.
And it was Brian Willits.
I mean, he's big to the degree that he has the ability to handle the physicality of college lacrosse as soon as he steps on campus. He seems like he has the right mindset in the sense of like he's a very calm and composed type of kid, very mature, the type that could handle taking that leap. He had the additional year, but even then, because he was recovering from surgery and didn't play a ton in his PG spring, he probably has an element of freshness. And I'm not actually certain, he might not have played at all. You know, so I and not only that, but he addresses a need as it relates to, you know, having a left-handed attackman. So I have a very strong feeling that.
Wait, is he a lefty?
I think so.
He's not ready.
I think he. I don't know. All right, I'm gonna dial that one back a little bit.
Okay, because I vividly remember him question marking back to his right hand to score.
Okay. But in any case, I think that, you know, they'll find a way to make that work offensively at the attack. And so it comes back to me, their biggest question heading into the season is their offensive creativity or creation from the midfield. And that's where, which Collins?
You're stealing all my thunder. I wrote so much about this, that the reason it's been delayed is it's, and I think at this point is up to 2,600 words. And I still have more to go.
Okay.
Because I just kept writing and just kept writing. My Notre Dame fall ball write up is it's going to be very long and very detailed about this.
Then let's.
But yeah.
Let's spend some time talking about the other three teams that are in contention for number one. First of all, do you guys agree? I mean, you know, you've had an opportunity to analyze.
I don't see Notre Dame as sort of in that group of potential number ones.
Okay. So do you think it's a three-team group with Carolina, Denver, and Maryland?
To me, I think it's a question of Denver or UNC.
Okay. What do you think, Kyle?
I think Maryland is pretty close. And I guess I wouldn't they're close enough to me that I sort of it's I don't think you're crazy to put them as number one over those teams. Where I think putting Notre Dame as number one over those teams, I think that's a little bit, I feel like that's outside the range of what I would, you know, think of a sort of an acceptable opinion.
I think that, I think part of that opinion would be derivative of the Notre Dame effect is now akin to the Duke effect in the sense that you expect them to be coached up. So even though you can identify clear roster flaws or at least areas of concern in the preseason, you're not going to punish them as you try to project towards who they're going to be at the end of the season. And that is definitely one of the inherent questions of an exercise like this. When you're creating a preseason qualification, are you trying to project where the teams are going to be when they take the field at the beginning of the season? Or are you trying to project where you think they're going to be when the season ends?
Well, if we're looking at end, I'm out on Maryland. Just forever. I'm done.
You should be good. You should be all about ranking them number two then.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm out on them where they're going to be. They're not going to be one. That's what we're talking about. They're not going to be one ever for me just because how many times can you put your hand on a hot plate and get it burned?
So you're telling me that if Brian Balcombe had gotten down on that shot a little bit slower and Maryland had won in overtime, you would feel better about ranking them?
Maryland was lucky to beat Brown because Brown slid five guys to the same pass that Maryland ran five times during the game. So let's just stop right there. I think Brown should have won that game. But to your point, fair enough. That's a good point. That's my other.
I mean, I think Maryland's really interesting that. as you look at them next year, because obviously, all right, you know, just among the guys that they graduated. So Weston Cole are 2/3 of their number, are their first midfield. Pat Young was their primary initiator and their second midfield. They graduated their number one long stick in Greg Denseglio. Their former first-team All-American goaltender, Kyle Bernlohr. Their former first-team All-American defenseman, Matt Dunn. And then Peter McCarney, who was kind of their second long-stick biddy. So that's a ton from the back end
of
the team.
Yeah, but they're getting...
Brian Neufeld back.
Yes.
They have Tim Muller and Mac Pons are their other two starting close defensemen. Isaiah Davis Allen.
Their defense is going to be fine. Yeah, Maryland's a team I feel like is like Notre Dame. I'm just not worried about their defense.
Their offense is returning their top two attackmen in Matt Rambo and Colin Heacock, and you know Jared Bernhardt's going to find a way to get on the field. You know, and then they've got some pretty decent depth and, you know, an experienced faceoff guy who's only a sophomore. So, again, okay, I think that my point is that the pieces are there. But I wouldn't argue for them to be number one either, primarily because of what they lost as opposed to what they lack coming back, which is interesting, I think.
I think they are a relatively complete team. But I guess the reason I like Denver as number one is I just think the star power, the high end, I think that Baptiste, Cannizzaro, and Zach Miller.
And Tyler Pace.
Tyler Pace. I guess I like Tyler Pace, but I love Zach Miller. I think Zach Miller could be the second best player in the country after Connor Cannizzaro.
What?
Not saying he is, but he's.
Are you a Bergdorf guy though?
Not especially.
You're not, right? I think we talked about this.
I think he is a good player. I look at him like I look at sort of like Brandon Mullins. That he's very good, but I didn't see him as a first team.
I knew you were gonna say that too. I knew you were gonna say that. Perfect answer, Patrick.
See, to me, he's more than that because he has like the first team All American athleticism, and I don't. But now this is I don't think he played well in 2016, but in 2015 he didn't make mistakes. Or at least he didn't make mistakes of the in volume to the degree that it should have prevented him from attaining that award.
I just think I look at it that when your defense is average, it's hard for me to say that your best defender is a first team All-American. In 2016 their defense was arguably slightly below average, but in 2015 it was pretty average. And when I say it, that, I mean, like, across D1, like, they had, like, their defense was, I would rank it somewhere in the 30s.
If your offense is that good, though, and as good as we're projecting it to be, how good does the defense have to be?
Oh, also, that's my point. That's why I like that.
Unit is
that's
like,
why, right. That's why, I mean, that's how they won the championship in 2015 and why I think they have a good shot to win it again in 2017. It's just, if we're talking about Christian Bergdorf and the defense, I think that defense, and it's a combination too, it's the face-off play and how slow they play, that if you just look at the number of goals they're giving up, it gives you a very inaccurate picture of how good that defense is. It's not as good as you think.
I mean, but they're hung with them for a game last year. You know, like that was a like 1-0 game to halftime. And that's, you know, not something you want to see from a top-tier team. You know, not to just pick out one game that was bad and they still ended up killing them in the end, but, you know, seeing that halftime score and being like, whoa, what's up with Denver? It is, if there's an Achilles heel, I don't think it's the defense. I think it's how slow they play with the amount of talent they have and speed they have on offense.
That was all about Richie Meade.
Controlling game.
That game was all about Richie Meade's return to Denver.
Yeah.
After the 2014 World Games.
Okay.
Patrick, do you give any stock or put any stock in the idea that if you are a defense that often plays with big leads, you're going to have less urgency to prevent goal scoring situations and you're really just trying to prevent fast possessions that end in goal scores? That you're more content to if you're a team that's leading 9-2 in the middle of the third quarter, you don't care if the opponent scores as long as he doesn't score in 30 seconds.
I don't think it has to do with scoring, because you're gonna. It's not like after the 30 seconds is up in the possession, it's like, okay, we're gonna stop trying and just let them score now. I think the way that you adjust, it's more you don't take risks to gamble to go for takeaways. You don't gamble to cause turnovers, and so you would rather them have the ball and not score. Whereas if you're down, there's some urgency to press out and take the ball away, even if it means risking giving up a goal because you need those possessions in order for your offense to come back.
I was just trying to ask it a circuitous way to find out whether or not you thought that a defense that is on the other end of the field balanced by an offense that can win games on its own, so to speak, is going to be more relaxed and as a result their statistical performance is not going to be representative of how good they are or can be.
I think it's tough. That'd be a question I would have to, that's like actually potentially a question to look into. I definitely could look into that in terms of our defenses that face fewer possessions per game. Is there any correlation with them being better or worse than you might expect in other situations? But I would almost argue that they almost should be better. Because you're not tired.
Mm-hmm.
I think so much of defense is hustle. And I think that it's the little hustle plays as far as getting out or sinking back in an extra step or two are oftentimes what make the difference. And when you face fewer possessions, you aren't going to be tired. And you have the energy, you know, to fight through that pick a little bit extra, you know, as a little bit extra hard that time when you face fewer possessions.
Isn't length of possession more important in that case, though? Aren't we looking at the length of the possession you're facing more than the number?
I don't think, does Denver's defense typically face longer possessions than other teams,
or
spend more time on the defensive end. I don't know that that's true.
They would more likely face shorter possessions because they hold the ball more offensively. Yeah. They have longer possessions offensively.
Yeah.
So arithmetic would suggest that either there's considerably fewer possessions in the game, which there may be, and that was your first point. And then secondly, that perhaps those possessions would be longer on average. But at both ends of the field, not just at the Denver offensive end.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I don't know the answer to, either in general or specifically to Denver.
So let's hit on the last contender for number one. How important, well, I guess, Patrick, and I guess this is a question for both of you, but I'll start with you, Patrick, just because now I feel like I'm playing host. What is Carolina's biggest flaw, or what about Carolina scares you the most heading into next year?
I think it's their defense. I don't think their defense wasn't particularly good last year, and they lost one of their leaders. They lost a couple of their leaders, a couple of senior guys, and Jake Mattei, Zeman's a midfielder. They lost Evan Connell. They lost Zach Powers.
To me, those two were depth guys. You know, both started.
I mean, Connell was the LSM, was a starting LSM. I think he started two or three years there.
Right.
Zach Powers definitely was a depth guy.
Right.
But I mean, I think that on defense, you know, your depth certainly does matter. He was the guy diving to close that shooter.
Right. No, there's no question about that. I think that when you look at the consistency to be good, I don't know. It's crazy because I think for the majority of his time in Chapel Hill, you know, people were waiting for Steve Pontrella to break out. He was an attackman. There wasn't really room for him on the attack. And then, you know, he takes over for Sankey and Pitter and puts up 70 points on a national championship winning team on an attack that was much different. I mean, you know, when the difference between a 2.2 primary initiator and a 1 primary initiator attack, I think, is pretty substantial. And that was essentially the transition Carolina made from 15 to 16. And it clearly worked. And when you look at what they have coming back with Klowinski and Cloutier, I'm sorry, Goldstock and Cloutier, you know, I expect that they would like to slide in a 1-for-1 replacement skill set wise for Pontrello. And to me, that's Timmy Kelly. And I think that there's a paradigm in the sense that he was, you know, an attackman who played a lot of midfield, and now, you know, would be shifting into a pure attack role. Obviously, Kelly is doing so as a sophomore as opposed to as a senior. And he's coming off of a U19 World Games in which I think he played that role. So I can see that, but to me, that's the big question. And having seen them play against Ohio State, I think that it only reaffirmed how important it is for Carolina to be able to do that, because they didn't look like they were getting looks easily. And I think that when you have a team set up like that and you want to be able to initiate from behind to complement guys like Michael Tagliaferro and Shane Simpson dodging from up top, you know, you need a guy that's going to be able to create his own shot and beat a man and draw a slide consistently. And that's, to me, the biggest question heading into
You don't think that's Goldstock?
Oddly, no. Well, first of all, I think Goldstock was a goal scorer as a sophomore, and I think that he showed a little bit more in terms of his ability to play make and carry the ball as a junior. And I was surprised by how explosive and athletic he looked against Ohio State, but I still don't consider him to be a traditional dodger. He's a wing dodger, a dodge off the catch. He actually did he dodged from up top for a goal against Ohio State that I was really impressed by. And maybe he could be. I just don't think of him that way.
I think he's an opportunistic dodger. He reminds me a little bit of speaking of Ohio State, of I would say like Colin Chell, where that's not what you really want. He can do it in spots when you know where it presents itself, but that's not his game.
Well, he's also got range too, though, right? So that kind of helps, like, setting up your dodge, is the ability to pull up and shoot.
In my mind, Luke Goldstock is the best player he can be for Carolina if he's 2 goals, 2 assists per game, primarily from that ready wing, and they have, you know, somebody from attack who's able to put up 50 points this year. 20 and 30 or so. because I guess what Goldschott can do that Cloutier can't is be productive every game. And so far throughout his career, we have seen Chris Cloutier put up 9-goal games in the NCAA semifinals, and not necessarily get blanked, but be, you know, a 1 or a 2-goal game type guy. And I think that Goldschott, because he's a senior, will be, like I said, his best self for Carolina if he represents a consistent scoring option without having to handle the primary dodging load.
So who's the one? If you're painting Goldschott as a two, who do you think Timmy Kelly's going to step into that one spot where Ponchiello was?
I mean, I think he's the only option right now that looks like he could do it. But that's why I say it's the biggest source of concern heading into next season.
No, that's fair, and I haven't watched them this fall, and I think my thought on the offense is I think they have enough talent that they'll figure it out. And I guess potentially that is maybe that is a hole where they don't have somebody who can step into it. But I look at them, I just think they and it's a part of the reason the end result I think vindicated me. I took a lot of heat for it early, but about ranking Carolina so high in like my preseason ratings that I had faith in them, that you just like they have a lot of talent. And it's sort of that it might take them a couple games, but I think on offense they'll figure it out. Which is why looking like they haven't quite figured out in the fall doesn't really concern me that much about them.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons they went to the championship game is because they were able to score these like goals, huge bunches, right? I mean, that's really where your root of concern for the offense is. It's like, can they do that again if they don't have Ponchiello? And, you know, first you said the defenseman, but really, like, looking back at losing a strength, I think is that like what you're saying?
Is that what I'm saying, or is that what Patrick's saying?
I mean, both of you guys seem like you're just kind of discounting their attack unit because they lost Ponchiello when Ponchiello was like a midfielder the year before.
Well, that's my point, though. Yeah, but he
was their leading scorer last year.
I have faith in them to figure it out.
He was their leading scorer by running in one circle and coming around the X and shooting.
And I think that's like, a really important thing for a team to be able to do. That's exactly my argument, actually.
If you can score goals with it, just because they know what it's coming, if they can't stop it, it's the goal counts the same.
I just think they have... those other two guys are more nuanced. And I think that I think, Patrick, you're right, that if they plug someone in there that can play those two guys' strength, and Terry, you're right, in a certain way as well, then there's not going to be much of a problem.
Well, okay, so here's my point, is that I don't think Timmy Kelly I don't think their ex-attackman needs to be their leading scorer in 2017 in order for them to be a national champion again. I do think that they will see increases in production overall from Goldschott and Cloutier to the degree that, you know, that guy can be, like I said, like a 40 to 50 point guy. The point I would make is he needs to more often than not, in more than 50% of their games, be guarded by the opponent's best defenseman in order to unlock the versatility and the different various ways that those two can be successful that you just said. Those two being Goldschott and Cloutier.
And they're the best because they're the best off the catch, either shooting or getting underneath.
Okay, I think that potentially wraps up our face-off yearbook discussion, kind of who's number one. One last thing that we wanted to talk about before we wrap up the podcast is the upcoming Inside Lacrosse Industry Summit.
Yeah.
That's taking place in January. Do you want to introduce that, Terry?
Sure. Well, so hopefully, if you're listening to this podcast, you've checked out the Industry Summit podcast from the first event, the inaugural event that we held in Philadelphia before the NCAA Final Four. I thought it was really cool, a really unique type of experience for those that were in attendance, and we want to do it again. I think that there was an opportunity. One of the goals with that summit was, we hear so frequently among folks that work in the lacrosse world, but not exclusively in the lacrosse world, that there isn't a moment to get together as an industry and talk about ways to improve and enhance, because the U.S. Lacrosse Convention happens in January when folks that work in college sports are focused on basketball. So let's put something together at the peak or the pinnacle of the lacrosse season, and we can have this kind of shared thought experience. And the downside to that was that folks who do work exclusively in lacrosse are already winding down and already setting their sights on either, you know, their summertime, which is kind of a different type of business, sometimes it's the core of their business, or, you know, already advancing to the following year, but also looking forward to some time off. And so, you know, this time, we wanted to have an industry summit that was, more catered toward the preseason portion of the conversation. So we're hosting it in Baltimore on January 19th in advance of the U.S. Lacrosse Convention, LaxCon, and we're really excited about it. We're putting together the lineup now. We think that there's a lot of opportunity for folks to come and network, enjoy themselves, learn a lot about what is going on, not just in the world of lacrosse, but also, you know, in the sporting world, sports media, sporting world at large, and apply some of those lessons to their own business. So, you know, this isn't necessarily for coaches who are interested in a chalk talk. You know, we want this to be for folks who are, you know, trying to stake their entrepreneurial claim in the world with a bent toward their passion for lacrosse.
Okay. I guess any thoughts, Kyle?
I would really like to present at this one. I would like to head a panel. I've already pitched it. I'm not going to ruin it here, but I think you should also pitch a panel. And I'm going to put this out there. Here's a little monkey wrench I'm throwing in there. I think we should do a live pod right there at the Lacrosse Industry Summit.
Ooh.
Yeah. What do you think about
that? That's true. We're going to get some good guests.
Absolutely.
Maybe we'll do a massive podcast.
You can't be on the pod if you don't show up.
Well, isn't that what we did by posting Patrick's session with Samir and Greg from East Coast Dives?
Yes. So hopefully we'll...
I have a feeling that we'll be able to pull that one off. Yeah. Out of all the uncontrollable variables, such as you hosting a panel, I think that's one that we'll be able to do.
Yeah. I believe I pitched it as, am I allowed to do a panel?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, which I feel like that was the correct word. And we're still deciding if that's yes or no. But, you know, that's our podcast for today. I am Kyle Devitt. I am the Gear and Lifestyle Editor at Inside the Cross. You can find me at the Kyle Devitt on Twitter and Instagram.
I'm Patrick McEwen, the Lacrosse Film Room guy. You can follow me at Lax Film Room on Twitter and Snapchat, or at Lacrosse Film Room on Instagram and YouTube.
And I'm Terry Foy. I'm the publisher of Inside Lacrosse. You can follow me on Twitter at Terrence Foy.
Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.